Artist Wendell Castle revolutionized the art world with a simple idea. Here he is explaining it to KCUR's Laura Spencer in 2011.
I thought that furniture, and very special furniture done in a very special way, ought to be accepted, displayed, collected, and bring the kind of money that sculpture did.
He was known as the father of the studio furniture movement of the 1960s and 70s. He built gorgeous chairs that look like art, because that is exactly what they are. They're in the world's most famous museums, and he kept on making them right up until the end. Sadly, Wendell Castle died last week. He was from Kansas.
I mean, I grew up in a rural community, Holton, Kansas. I never studied cabinet making or furniture design or any of those things. The only shop class I ever had in my life was seventh grade shop in Coffeyville, Kansas.
One shop class and not a single course in furniture design, but still, as his New York Times obituary puts it, he coaxed wood and other materials into weird, mind-bending shapes like giant teeth or tongues or elephant's feet that you could sit on. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear about Wendell Castle's life and his unconventional path to the top of the art world. We're joined by a whole panel this morning, but I want to start with Glenn Adamson. He's a curator, writer, and historian based in Brooklyn, and he worked closely with Wendell Castle. Hi, Glenn.
Hi there, Gina.
What would you tell someone who's never seen Wendell Castle's work, who's never heard of this guy before, about what he did and why he matters?
Well, I think the best way to come to Wendell's work is to throw away everything you think you know about furniture and start from scratch. And that's really what he did. As you just heard, he did not have any traditional training as a furniture maker. He trained as a sculptor, and he developed a lot of techniques and processes that would let him make furniture in a totally unconventional way.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, maybe the best known technique from early in his career is called stack lamination. And what that means is that he took boards and stacked them up, glued them to one another, and he made a kind of rough shape in that way, and then just started carving into it with a chainsaw, angle grinders, and then finally chisels. And using that technique, he could make absolutely any form that he wanted, very different from traditional joined furniture. So that furniture, in fact, looks more like a sculpture by Henry Moore, let's say, than it does like anything you would have seen in a usual living room.
You've called him the most important post-war furniture designer.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
Explain.
So what makes him important for American post-war design is that he really has this imagination that is unbridled, and he carries on with one innovation after another over a course of, well, more than 50 years, sometimes returning to some of his older ideas, sometimes paving totally new ground. And that's really something you don't see from anybody else in the field of furniture. It's just the uniqueness and individuality and ultimately the intensity of his imagination that I'd like to respect and recall now that he's passed.
Well, we will get back to that. But do you remember meeting him for the first time?
Oh, yes. He's unforgettable.
To us about that, how he came across that first meeting.
Well, you know, one thing, it's funny, he just mentioned in that clip you played that he took classes from Coffeyville. In Coffeyville, he learned a little bit of shop there. And actually, my grandfather was from Coffeyville, Kansas. And so that whole Midwestern personality was very strong in him. He had an incredible work ethic and incredible plain-spokenness. But also, he was extremely elegant. So he wore beautiful tailored suits and immaculate wingtip shoes. He drove a Bentley car late in his life. So he had this wonderful combination of being, on the one hand, totally pragmatic, something I think he got from his Kansas roots, and also very, very cosmopolitan. You know, he would go to Italy, he would go all over Europe. And there was a lot that sort of seemed to coalesce in this man between the local and the global.
I have encountered him. I wouldn't say I met him. We didn't speak or anything, but I saw him, and he visually, it's not just his clothes. I mean, he had this curly chin length gray hair and these very whimsical round glasses.
Yeah, he had these candy color glasses. The frames sort of glinted around his eyes, and his eyes were pretty shiny to begin with. So he just had an incredible presence to him, didn't he?
Yeah, I've read someone describing him as like that he seemed like a genius who didn't realize what the fuss was all about.
That's a great thing to say. Yes, he had a modesty to him that really belied his achievements. And I think he knew on some level that he had really reinvented furniture as we know it. But on the other hand, he was mainly interested in the next thing he was going to make. And, you know, this is a guy that really spent every day of his life that he could in the studio, you know, not just 6 days a week, but 7 days a week. He would be in there drawing, carving models, then getting out the chainsaw and actually working into the wood. He had a large team of people he worked with who, you know, depended on him for their livelihoods, and he really looked after them beautifully and really made an amazing studio to visit as well. So this is a guy that was really always turning his mind to the next thing, not just looking back at his achievements.
There's a story he used to tell about his time at KU where he studied industrial design and sculpture. And I guess he didn't have a toolbox. So one of the first things he did in a sculpture class was build himself a toolbox. And the teacher was sort of miffed that he was spending valuable studio time that way. And he thought, well, why isn't this toolbox art if I made it in this class?
And yeah, that's right. That's right. He said, well, I'll show you. I can make a toolbox into art. And, you know, then there will be no contradiction. And that's what he went on to do.
I mean, what does that say to you, not just about him, but also about the way he interacted with the art world?
Well, he was a man who liked a challenge. He liked to challenge himself. And I think that was partly, again, the work ethic, but it was also just seeing what would happen if he pushed himself. He had this very, you know, funny, wise set of rules that he liked to follow, that he published. There were 10 of them. And my favorite has always been, if you hit the target every time, then the target's too close to you. So he had this idea that you always have to reach further, try to get somewhere where you've never been before.
Well, before we dive too deep into that, just a little bit of his personal story. I'm going to turn to one of our local guests in a moment, but one of the first things you write about him in the remembrance that you've written, it's really lovely, is that he struggled with dyslexia growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's quite moving. And this is something I know because he gave a talk actually to a group of students and other furniture makers. So he was very open about it. And he said basically that when he was growing up, you know, as a child and then as a teenager, he felt like he wasn't good at anything, and people basically, horrible to say, but people thought he was stupid because he had such severe dyslexia that he just couldn't cope with the schoolwork. And now, of course, we know much better understood today than it was then that a lot of artistic people have dyslexia, and it seems to all be kind of hooked up or wired in that way.
And that it's not a measure of intelligence, of course.
Exactly. And certainly, you wouldn't ever say that Wendell Castle was anything but incredibly intelligent, both as an artist and as a, you know, as a businessman, you know, leading his own studio, and also as somebody who thought deeply about what he was doing intellectually. So he was able to get through that really by discovering art. And so it was, I think, in some ways, from his perspective, a little bit of a miracle that he was able to rise above that beginning that he had had and the frustration. And I think also the struggles with self-confidence that he had. And, you know, maybe in terms of what it meant for him later in life, it meant that he never took it for granted, you know, that he had to really fight for what he had. And he was proud. But then, of course, he always had that underlying modesty as well.
Well, I want to bring in Susan Earle now. She's the curator of European and American art at the Spencer Museum in Lawrence. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Gina.
What else can you tell us about Wendell Castle's upbringing here in Kansas?
Well, I appreciate everything Glenn has already mentioned. He grew up in a farm or near a farm, as we mentioned, and his grandparents were farmers. His Kansas roots were very meaningful to him, and I think it's part of why he came back to KU many times, including most recently just a few months ago for a Distinguished Alumni Award from the School of Architecture and Design. And then his honorary doctorate that he received in May of 2013 was so meaningful for him. He really almost kind of teared up in the interview that he did with our director, Sarah Lynn Rees-Hardy, and our photographer, Ryan Wagner, at his studio, when he was talking about how meaningful it was for him to receive an award from the University of Kansas that had meant so much.
Did he explain what it was that was so poignant for him about that?
Well, he said the other schools from which he had received honorary doctorates did not have a particular tie to him, which is kind of unusual, I guess, but that KU recognizing him felt just so important to him. It was a school that had meant so much to him. And although he felt like he did well on one level and on other levels struggled, but I think to be recognized by that university meant so much. And I think it in his home state also was really meaningful for him.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard that growing up, maybe his community didn't recognize him as like a future great anything. And I wonder what more you can tell me about that. I mean, it does seem like it would be especially poignant for someone who grew up that way to get that level of recognition from the flagship university in their state. But yeah, take me back a little bit more to, yeah, just his family, his community.
So I haven't met his family members, but it sounds like he had a fairly typical kind of rural and isolated life. They lived outside of Emporia. Emporia is a wonderful community, and I don't know how well known he was within the community. He does seem like he was pretty shy growing up, and even as Glenn mentioned, as an adult, he was very unassuming. He had this incredible combination of presence and style, very notable style that really would rivet people when they saw him. But very unassuming, and I think that's part of perhaps what he learned growing up in a humble environment. And so, you know, would his peers have recognized anything about him? Probably not. I mean, that's part of what makes him so fascinating, is that he could come from a modest background in which he may have had, you know, few friends or little recognition as a child, and yet he totally flourished once he found his voice and his mediums, which he, you know, bent to such a degree that, you know, it's completely changed the way we think about both furniture and sculpture.
When he came to KU, as he told us earlier in the show, in that recording with Laura Spencer, he didn't study furniture design. He studied industrial design.
Yes, and that is still what one would study if you came to KU and wanted to study furniture. The category would be industrial design, which is really interesting. And they, you know, he said that some of his professors didn't want him to go in the kind of furniture direction. But what's amazing is that it sounds like industrial design was sort of a compromise with his family of how to let him not quite study art, but do something that would theoretically be more practical. But he took all the practicality that he learned from that. And we, you know, to this day have some real artists who teach in that area. So his bending of those categories continues to be an influence at University of Kansas and many other places. So, but he learned some of the techniques that, you know, involved that led to product design, so that part of his later output was informed by all of that background. It's just amazing how he took that training and then the sculpture training and didn't really hew that closely to either one in a traditional way, but made them into something extraordinary.
So talk to me about his early career. How did he go from being this guy who's sort of challenging his professors a little bit at KU to being someone who's collected in museums worldwide and who is known really as the father of an art movement?
So he really just seemed to charge out on his own. I think having had such strong roots in Kansas and then attending university in his home state, I think then gave him the wings to really fly. And he headed straight to New York City after he graduated with his master's in sculpture. And before that, I think he had already submitted a work to an exhibition at the Nelson Atkins Museum as a sculpture. And so he had an amazing amount of confidence given his modesty and his admission of his struggles, but he charged on ahead. So he showed a work at the Nelson Atkins very early, went to New York City.
What was it?
It was his, I think, a chair, but he exhibited it as a sculpture. So that was sort of an important small milestone for him.
And that was unusual at that time, that a chair would be a sculpture. Because now you do see that. I mean, that's in a modern art wing of a museum. You see that.
Right. But you wouldn't have seen it then. You wouldn't have seen it in 1960. It just would not have happened. So that he went to the studio, when he went on a road trip with a friend, that he, you know, knocked on the door of Alexander Calder, that he felt confident enough to just show up at the home of a famous kinetic sculpture artist, and that Calder welcomed him in. You know, he clearly had this kind of ambition combined with this modesty that really made it so that some doors opened and others closed, but he just kept charging ahead. And I think being in New York then was a help for him.
Describe some of your favorite works by Wendell Castle. I'm guessing that some of those are at the Spencer Museum.
Yes, they are. He has many other wonderful works, but in 2003, I approached him about acquiring one of his sculptures. He had started a new series that, you know, turned even more things on their heads from what he had done. We acquired a work that I proposed called Hanging in the Balance. And it's a chair that would be completely non-functional because there's no seat. It's just the outlines of a chair made of bronze, and it's turned upside down onto what looks like a pillow. And many people are convinced it's an actual soft pillow. They want to put their head down on it, but it's made out of wood. So he used this trompe l'oeil, or fooling the eye, that he had loved his whole career. And he started a new way of using it where he combined the hard and the soft, but both of them are still made out of these hard materials. So that work is a real star in our collection. It's become one of our signature works. People make pilgrimages to see it. Then he gave us recently, when he got the honorary doctorate, this amazing chair called Nirvana in 2013. And it's from an edition. There are others, but he repainted our chair from a more purplish to a more bluish color to reflect his devotion to the University of Kansas and to mimic the kind of Jayhawk blue.
You know, I want to bring Glenn back in on this, too. I'd like for the both of you to talk about the importance of craft in his work. In that interview he did with Laura Spencer in 2011, he said that of all the tools he uses, and we've already heard that he uses a chainsaw, but that his pencil is the most important. Glenn, can you talk to me about that? We appear to have lost Glenn. Susan.
Sure. So some artists use pencil in drawings and some don't. Wendell Castle always did, as far as I know. And he described that he would put the pencil on the paper and not know where it was going. It's kind of like, you know, writing in a journal and just keeping your pencil down and you don't know what's going to unfold. So that I think it was a way for ideas and forms to form on paper for him. And he used that then to create his sculptures.
You know, he started off his career making furniture/sculpture that emphasized originality. It emphasized using all of the sophisticated visual language that artists bring to sculpture. And then he shifted to a period where he decided to try something new, recreating old furniture forms, but then doing something kind of funny to them. And when you talk about Hanging in the Balance, like the pillow, it's sort of like this sense of humor. And that was known as this trompe l'oeil period. When Laura interviewed him in 2011, she asked him how his work had evolved, and he told her that later in life he came back full circle to that early idea of starting from scratch with nothing but his own vision. Here's what he said.
That was actually quite successful in the art world, but it wasn't fulfilling to me in the end because I didn't get to sit at the drawing table the way I am at this moment, trying to discover new things and new ideas, and I don't ever want to be that person that just makes the same thing over and over again because somebody will buy it. I want to discover new things and take risks.
You know, Glenn, you were talking earlier about his incredible imagination and his unusual push toward always doing something new. What do you hear?
I think in terms of his recent work particularly, one thing that is absolutely astonishing to me is the way that he was able to take on robotics at the end of his career. This was maybe a surprising move, but he actually went out and bought a robot carving arm that he got from the post office, if you can believe that. So the device had recently been used to sort of pick and place packages in a post office sorting center, and he repurposed it in order to be able to carve wood with it and then use that device as a way of creating these monumental furniture forms over the past 10 years or so.
Man, I mean, robotics, taking on robotics at what age?
Well, he started a little bit before he was 80, but he really figured it out over the last, 5 years. So I'd say between the age of 80 and 85. So we're talking about an octogenarian here.
Well, we're going to take a short break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll pick right back up with the story of Wendell Castle, a Kansas native who died last week. He made furniture that looked like art, or art that was furniture. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with Spencer Museum curator Susan Earle and Brooklyn-based writer and curator Glenn Adamson. They've been sharing the life story of Wendell Castle, an art world giant who died last week at 85. He had a distinctive look, curly gray hair down past his chin and whimsical round glasses, and he stayed close to his humble Kansas roots, even though he went on to change the art world in a big way by making furniture that was art in the 1960s. Mo Dickens is here with us too, and I want to bring him in now. Mo is the curator at the Belger Art Center, and he organized an exhibit that brought Wendell Castle to Kansas City in 2011. Hi, Mo.
Hello.
You knew Wendell's art before you met him. What struck you about the work itself?
Well, in the Belger collection, we have a giant desk. It's a three-tiered desk that folds up, and there's chairs made to go with it. And it's a well-made object. And we have a giant lamp. It's unlike any lamp you've ever seen. And
Wait, okay. So this desk, I'm also guessing, is unlike any desk I've ever seen?
Yeah. In fact, the catalog resume that was being put together recently asked me to send them a picture. And I sent them a picture of this desk, and they went, "Oh, we didn't know you had so much of his work." And I went, "That's one piece."
Well, so describe it. Describe these pieces.
It's about the size of the desk we're sitting at here, which for viewers at home, it's about the size of a room. But it's on pivots. There's three sections of various heights, and they come out into the space, but you're able to fold them up. And there's this huge, it's a stacked lamination piece. Glenn Adamson mentioned that Wendell perfected that way of working. So it looks like one solid piece of wood that's almost like carving into a rock, only it's wood. And the signature, I love showing people the signature at the base of this pedestal holding up one section of the table. It just says WC76. If you've seen his work these days, he signs it Castle 2010 or did Castle 2011. Very elegant script. But in those days, it looked like a R. Crumb signature, just a WC76, kind of like a hippie signature on a desk, like a hippie desk. But a very valuable, well-made. So, when I started working at the Belger, I wasn't that familiar with him, but we do a lot of art shows, but we had this furniture sitting around, and I came to tell my visitors, I said, "I guess what Mr. Belger collects is the well-made object. He doesn't really worry about whether you call it furniture or art or sculpture." And Susan alluded to his education at KU, and he got his MFA in sculpture. I found an old interview he did with Smithsonian one time, and it came from a small town in Kansas. So the interviewer said, "What did your parents think about you studying art?" And he said, "Oh, they had no problem with me studying art. They just had a problem with me going to KU." And the interviewer said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, my parents were K-State fans." Which I'm sure meant nothing to the Smithsonian people, but I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, and so just quickly, the lamp, tell me about this lamp.
Oh, it's about 4 feet tall, and it sits on a green block, and the green block is the size of an old television set, and then it has these giant curving legs that come off of it. So most people do not recognize it as a lamp. It's a functioning lamp, but it looks more like a monster coming down the hallway on the second floor at a Belger.
So when you did finally meet him, what made you decide to bring him to town and do an exhibition of his work?
Well, actually, I have to credit Dick and Evelyn Belger for that. That was their idea. I didn't know at the time that the Nelson had never done a solo show with Wendell. And being a local hero, I assumed that had already happened. So we were able to do this. And the Nelson's working on one now. It's going to open this summer. And Stephanie K. DeLogos is working on that. And I'm sure it's going to be great. And they're going to have pieces that people can actually sit on.
That's cool.
Nobody could sit on the work we did back in 2011. It was highly polished surfaces. And you could see the frustration on my visitors. They wanted to sit in these chairs so bad. I offered to put on flannel pajamas to sit in one. And Mr. Belger still said, no way. The surfaces are too polished.
Well, so what impression did he make when you did meet him?
The coolest guy. Glenn talked about what a stylish dresser he was. And he was. But opening night, he decided to demonstrate that these rocking chairs would actually rock. And they were huge pieces. They're more like playground
equipment. Huge. How big?
They're roughly three times the size of a regular rocking chair, but elongated, not height-wise. So he kicked off his elegant shoes, and he had on these rainbow-striped socks, and he put the socks on the runner of the rocking chair, and he just started rocking like a little kid, and that thing was flying. And he looked so happy. He could have passed for 55 or 60 years old, but he was approaching 80 at the time. And I said, Wendell, you're almost 80. Are you thinking about retiring? And he looked around the gallery at all that new work, and he said, and do what? What's more fun than this?
Yeah, I mean, rocking in a giant rocking chair does sound fun.
That you made.
Yeah. Susan, jump in here, because he did, as you mentioned, come back to KU a lot and interacted with students there. I mean, we just heard Mo's description of his playfulness. Can you tell us any more about just how he interacted with KU students?
Well, I think he just continued to inspire them every time he was there. And I think he shared a lot from his own experience. And they learned from his style. They learned from his methods, his rules that were so interesting.
And tell me more about the rules. Glenn mentioned them earlier, but I'd like to know more about Wendell Castle's rules. It's rules for art making or for life?
Well, they're more rules for life, and I haven't memorized them, but they're very, they're funny, they're witty, they're pithy, and they're things like expect the unexpected, but they're more unexpected than that, so that he would say something, and then it goes in the other kind of direction. So I think what he's done for so many students there is his ideas were very freeing, because he really didn't, although he drew in preparation for sculpture, which some think people would call traditional, you know, he didn't just thrash around in any way. He did preparation. But I think he was very liberating for students there. And one of the projects that we did, I was so fortunate to work with some of our students and curate an exhibition of his work called Wendell Castle About Time. And he showed in that exhibition, and the students loved this, an installation kind of work. It was a huge form, a metal, polished metal form that was probably 12 feet long, and it rotated around in a circle to tell time. And it was a way for us to think. Nobody now thinks about the millennium having turned in 2000, but at the time it loomed large in everyone's mind. Were our computers going to shut down? What was going to happen? And we thought that Wendell Castle was the perfect person to think about time with. So he created these pieces that addressed time in completely unconventional ways.
Glenn, I mean, just thinking about this person and his overarching legacy, what do you hope that people take from the story of his life, or from the way he worked, or the way he related to his craft, to the art world, to expectations?
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess, you know, for me, it's really the lesson of going out there and defining your own adventure. he did start from, you know, fairly humble roots. And he then went on to this incredible career, really, on the basis of nothing but his own imagination. So I think the reason he was inspiring to so many students was that he was like this, you know, human permission slip, you know, just go and do whatever you think would be most interesting. I was thinking back to those rules again, the 10 adopted rules of thumb, as he called them. And another one of them was a dog that stays on the porch gathers no bones, which sounds like Kansas wisdom to me. But, you know, I think that's the kind of, as the kind of feeling you had being around him. It wasn't just what he was doing and what he was accomplishing, but also the sense that he gave you that you could maybe accomplish something that nobody had ever dreamt of too.
You know, we haven't fully touched on this, but I mean, he was doing something really groundbreaking at the time. And at this point, you know, he has imitators and there's a whole, like I said, you do see furniture in museums now. I mean, can you talk about, was that a difficult sell for him, or did people embrace him pretty easily? I mean, he's done this innovative thing, but and he made a big name for himself doing it. It seems like that doesn't usually happen quickly or easily.
That's right. You know, he really invented a genre, certainly here in America. And even in other countries, you know, Italy, for example, is famous for its great designers. And Wendell was very inspired by Italian design, particularly when he did his very innovative plastic furniture in the 60s. But he really, you know, broke through that glass ceiling that the medium of furniture or craft more generally had always kind of lurked underneath, and showed that you could be as sculpturally inventive, as formally creative in a functional form as you could in a non-functional form. And he had his struggles with that. I think a lot of people wanted to categorize him in some kind of, you know, side pocket of the art world. But in a way, he was even more ahead of his time than maybe he realized, because now in the 21st century, we're realizing that these categories of art or craft or design or furniture or sculpture, you know, what's more interesting is maybe to move from one to the other in this totally fluid manner. And he was already doing that way back in the 60s. And frankly, the rest of the art world is just catching up to him in that respect.
Glenn Adamson, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And Susan Earle, Mo Dickens, thank you both as well.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you.
Wendell Castle died last week at the age of 85. His works from the Spencer Museum's collection are on view, and the Nelson has an upcoming exhibition of his work that will be here in late June. I'm Gina Kaufman in KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now, man, the flu is crazy this year. If it seems really bad to you, you're not alone. A guy in San Francisco who makes something called a smart thermometer to collect data says Missouri is the most flu-ridden state in the country, and Kansas is a close second, which makes Kansas City just like a bullseye of some weird kind. Let's talk to Kansas City Star's Andy Marceau about it. He's been following this story. Hi, Andy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, first of all, this year's flu doesn't just seem to be spreading like crazy. It also seems to be just really taking people out of a commission in a way that strikes me just observationally as unusual, but maybe that's just perception on my part.
No, I think it is more severe this year. The predominant strain this year is something called influenza A H3N2, and that one has appeared to be more hard on people, especially, you know, the elderly, young people, and people with underlying medical conditions. So yeah, we're seeing a higher number of hospitalizations than is normal for a normal flu year.
You know, so do I understand correctly that there are places in Missouri where hospitals are running out of room for flu patients?
Well, I think that that was earlier this month, when things were really kind of at their peak, kind of mid-January, I would say, and it was, you know, a situation where there were emergency departments that were going on what's called ambulance diversion, which means they were still taking walk-ins, but they were full enough that they were instructing ambulances to go to other hospitals. And as best I can tell, at the worst point, about a third of the hospitals in the Kansas City area were on ambulance diversion. So, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, a critical, there's no beds anywhere type of deal, but there was a lot of flu activity and it was causing some problems and people were having to go.
And like parking lot clinics.
Well, yeah, that in particular I saw in California. I'm not sure that was anything that we've seen here in Missouri or Kansas. But yeah, even earlier in January, at the beginning of January, I think the flu was worse out in California. And there was, photos of a hospital that had set up a giant triage tent in the parking lot, which is not something you usually see except in like natural disasters. So that was striking.
You report on the flu, you know, year after year, I'm guessing. I mean, it's always a story of some kind. What strikes you about this year, other than just the high numbers?
Well, so this year is, according to the CDC, it's the worst flu season since 2009 when we had the swine flu. And the thing about the swine flu was that was a pandemic because it was a new strain. It was a novel strain of influenza that had not been seen before, and so that caused a lot of problems. This predominant strain this year is something we've seen before, and yet our vaccine is not particularly effective against it. But medical professionals are still strongly, strongly recommending you get the vaccine. I believe the estimates are it will prevent anywhere from 10% to 30% of influenza A, H3N2 cases completely. And even in the cases it's not able to prevent, it is going to lessen the symptoms so that you'll be less likely to be hospitalized and less likely to have those really bad effects from it. So it is a little bit striking that in a year when we don't have a novel flu strain, we're still struggling with the flu this much. And I think that speaks to the need for a universal flu vaccine. And I was speaking to
one that covers all the different strains.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can get it once and it'll be good for, say, 5-10 years or something. And then you get a booster and just like kind of your normal other shots. And I was talking to Marianne Jackson, who's the head of pediatric infectious diseases over at Children's Mercy. And she said that this year in particular, she feels like she's hearing a lot more push generated for that universal flu vaccine. And so that could be a silver lining that comes out of this year.
But with something that's got novel strains that do arise, I mean, that seems like a tough challenge.
It is, and that's why we haven't done it yet. But Dr. Jackson believes that there's kind of a critical mass of voices now saying, like, we need to really invest in this and we need to get going on this because we need something better, essentially.
Let's talk to Dr. Steve Lauer, who's with us from KU Med. Hi.
Good morning.
So we've just heard a little bit about the big picture of what this flu looks like. But when we hear about things like hospitalizations and the high numbers of hospitalizations, what kinds of symptoms are people being hospitalized for this year?
Well, it's the same ones that you always get with serious flu. What gets people in the hospital are either just they're feeling so poorly that they get dehydrated or that they have respiratory symptoms. It settles into the lungs and they develop pneumonia and therefore have trouble breathing, keeping their oxygen levels up, and need some help with that.
I mean, the people's sort of popular idea of the flu doesn't usually include so many of those respiratory symptoms. Is this year's flu especially respiratory in its symptoms, or is that always part of it that we just don't talk about as much?
Well, I think there's confusion. There's a lot of things that are covered by the word flu versus influenza. People talk about stomach flu and other kinds of flu just to generically cover the idea of a viral infection, whereas influenza is a very specific subtype of that and really does tend to be much more where the problems are around respiratory symptoms. So a lot of times we hear, well, I got the flu shot and I still got the flu because I was vomiting and had diarrhea, things like that. And there's a lot of just generic flu out there that isn't really influenza.
So with the high numbers of people getting sick, mm-hmm. how does a doctor's office still function? I mean, we've heard about hospitals having trouble, but I imagine doctors' offices are having challenges of their own, just keeping up and keeping their own staff healthy.
Absolutely. One of the biggest problems we have is just that mix of more and more sick patients, which means our own staff are exposed much more often, and therefore they're sicker. So one of the things that our clinic managers are having to balance is this role of our own people being out this year. But still the biggest one is, you know, our nurses are working extremely hard trying to triage out those patients who really don't need to be seen, because while they're sick, they're okay, versus who are those patients who really do need to be in to be seen and at least evaluate and see how they're doing.
Well, what do you think about, I mean, at what point do you advise people that they need to get up out of bed and head to the doctor or take a sick child? How do you observe that symptom in your child or a relative?
Well, the biggest things we're really looking for, and I think in any patient, is are they having difficulty breathing, really breathing harder, faster, and therefore worries that that infection has settled into their lungs? And do they just feel so poorly that they're not keeping up with their fluid intake and therefore getting dehydrated? So trying to get an assessment of that, you know, on the phone and see if they can sort that out and decide if that patient really, it is worthwhile for them to come in and to be seen, or are we just making matters worse by putting, you know, a lot of sick people into the same waiting room and same clinic space, putting them all together, which is how it spreads in the first place.
So how, I mean, yeah, so you just make that call based on one of those two symptoms, either the appearance that someone's becoming dehydrated, that's a case where it's worthwhile to get up and go to the doctor or hospital, and then if they're having trouble breathing, those are the two?
Those are the biggest ones in the, you know, for a pediatric office like the one I work in, that's the things that we're really trying to sort out on the phone. That's always a challenge, and so oftentimes the better part of valor is just to have them come in and be seen and make sure that they're doing okay. So it's that balance and trying to sort that out.
You know, you mentioned that you are in a pediatric practice, and we usually do hear that there's a particular threat with the flu for children and the elderly as far as what the consequences tend to be. I mean, is that what we're seeing again this year?
Yes, it seems, you know, just because especially the younger a child is, have they seen flu before, just because of their size and the way they'll respond to a viral infection, they are certainly at more risk. And that seems to be the pattern again, as always this year. But there's also plenty of otherwise healthy adults who are really being hit hard by the symptoms, the people who are out really not being able to go to work for a week, 10 days, things like that, just because they feel so poorly with this infection.
How do you recommend that people manage those, you know, 10-day and longer stretches? I've known people who have been out for weeks.
Mm-hmm. It's really, you know, it's kind of boring, but it's really, you just have to take care of yourself, keep yourself hydrated, keep try and get some food in so your body can work to fight off this illness. There's really generally not much else to do. There's really not a magic cure for this. It's just that back and forth with a particularly strong strain of the flu influenza virus this year that's really affecting people.
You know,
and then of course paying attention when you really being able to tell that difference between I just feel terrible but I'm doing okay versus I'm really worried about, you know, I can't breathe, I'm really in a situation now where I need to be seen.
We heard Andy Marceau say that that people are still recommending, that the CDC is still recommending the flu shot. Is that still your recommendation as well?
Absolutely. And as Andy said, the purpose of the flu vaccine, because of the variability in that influenza virus every year, the purpose of the vaccine is a little different than, say, the measles vaccine. The We really think of the flu vaccine as trying to prevent those serious consequences, being in the hospital, having a pneumonia, really needing respiratory care. That's the purpose of the vaccine. It's not going to prevent everybody from getting influenza, but it really does seem to play a big role in preventing the really serious side effects.
I mean, including death, there have been a number of fatalities this year.
Yes, and that is true every year in pediatrics. Every year there's somewhere between 50 to 150 children die in this country every year from influenza, likely many more elderly who die. The numbers vary on that, but it's many thousands a year estimated to die from influenza in the U.S.
Are there any shortages of flu vaccine? I mean, when you're talking about that, that's the way to prevent real severity of consequences.
This year, I think most of the time places, practices and offices have been able to get vaccine as things ramped up and it became clear this was going to be a more serious than average year. I think there may have been some short-term shortages, but as far as I know, people have been able to get the vaccine and still have it available in their offices.
You know, I want to turn to Andy Marceau. We were just hearing about that children and the elderly are of course, the people to really watch. But I did hear NPR's Rob Stein reporting that nationally this year has been unusually hard on baby boomers. Is that something that you know, whether we're seeing that in Kansas City?
I don't know about Kansas City specifically, but yeah, nationally I've heard that that is something that's kind of differentiated this year. It's not just, the quite elderly people in their like late 70s and 80s and 90s, but there are, people who are mid 50s or, in their 60s who are getting very serious complications from influenza this year. And I have even read, there's been a few national reports about people who are kind of in their, physical peak years, in their 20s and 30s. And those are really scattered reports. That's very rare. But that's still a little jarring when, you're somebody like me who's in your 30s and you hear about, a mother who's 37 and died of influenza and didn't get her shot this year. And most years she gets her shot. So, I read that story just a few weeks ago, and yeah, that did strike me.
You know, with people being so sick this year, so many people being so sick, I am wondering if there's also like an economic fallout that you would expect to see with that. I was in a doctor's office building, and I don't know, specifically what this particular office did, but on one of the doors, there was a sign that said, "We are closed because of the flu." Like, this office couldn't stay staffed because so many people were out. And, I've run across situations where, you're not hearing back from someone and you realize that a whole office was basically out with the flu and the person wasn't getting back to you because of that. I mean, just how is this affecting the normal function of our two states?
Yeah, we're not going to know the economic effects until later down the road, but there are some that are observable already. There's been entire school districts that have closed in some parts of Missouri, and I believe a couple in Kansas as well, closed for a day or two. I've talked to some hospital administrators who have said, "Oh yeah, we've had to do a whole lot of overtime already this year because, they've been at what they call surge staffing. They've been calling up every nurse they can, essentially. And so, I've had administrators tell me, we're already, and this was weeks ago, we already are above what we budgeted for overtime for January. So there's going to be some economic effects for sure. And some of those are really hard to quantify. The loss of productivity, just people being out of work, that's hard to really pin a hard number on, but there will be some estimates of that, I'm guessing, in the next few months.
So, Steve Lauer, as we go, just the bullet point advice for staying healthy in the middle of all of this.
Get your vaccine, wash your hands, cover your cough. If you're sick, stay home.
Okay, I think we can handle that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Andy Marceau with us from the Kansas City Star. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
We have more reporting on this year's flu on our website, kcur.org, and you can listen back to this morning's conversations or send them to a friend at kcur.org/Central Standard. Earlier this morning, we heard about artist Wendell Castle, super interesting guy and a big name out of Kansas. Check that out if you missed it, kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, a local researcher just went to Antarctica and brought back plants. We will talk about her adventure tomorrow at 10. We'll also check in with a Kansas Cityan who's joined the relief efforts in his native Puerto Rico. We'll hear what he's seeing back home, so be sure to tune in. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.